In 5 days' time.
René carried Théotiste across the river, Elphège stumbling behind. Marie, gripping Renardette's reluctant hand, was the first across, moving as though on a firm path beneath the water, then striding eastward along the dim path to Wobeek.
"Are your people in Wobeek?"
René asked her, although everything he had heard indicated otherwise.
"No, no Wobeek."
She spoke in a low voice.
"Then where?"
For a long time she said nothing. When they stopped at noon to make tea, she said,
"Sobegan Nakadi, river people we. All our life that river, other river. Miga Magi our place. Good rivers, good food, eel, fish, good medicine plant. Better. Here no good."
She handed corn cakes spread with cacamousse to the children.
"How did you come to Monsieur Trepanier's house?"
he asked. But she did not answer, and they walked in silence until they reached Wobeek the next noon. Marie stopped at the edge of the settlement, near the path to the mission church.
"Here," she said, "confession, mass, read, write, talk French, by Père Pelot."
She gave him 2 corn cakes for his return journey.
"You read? You write?"
said René, astonished and jealous. He had seen no evidence of these skills in Marie.
"Bientôt," she said. "Soon."
And with the silent children, she took the path to the mission and the priest's house. Only Elphège turned to look at him. René's glance swept the ground, and when he saw a sabot de la Vierge, he picked it and pinned it to his shirt with a willow sliver, enjoying the musky perfume. He went on to the deputy's house. 100 yards away, the river glittered and pranced in the sunlight. 2 huge canoes were drawn up on the shore, and under the spruce trees, a group of men and a few Indian women were making camp. Fur traders from the Pays d'en Haut, heading for Tadoussac or Quebec. They were a rough-looking lot, great triangles of shoulders, chest, neck and arms balanced on bandy legs, bearded, dark-skinned from smoky fires, their tasseled red hats covering oily hair. One muscular fellow lurching under 2 heavy packs caught his eye. There was something about him René thought he knew. The man swiveled away and went into the shadow under the trees.
"Ah, Monsieur Sel."
Monsieur Bouchard, the deputy, was cordial and smiling, his yellow eyebrows raised in pleasure at seeing the young woodcutter from the forest. René explained that Monsieur Trepanier had renamed Leonardette Renardette because he thought the birthmark resembled a fox face, and he had sent Marie and the children away. He wanted to have his trunks brought out to his house.
"Ah, that is what fine fellows do when a moneyed lady with connections comes in sight. Yes, Philippe Boss can bring his trunks out, for a consideration which I'm sure the elegant Monsieur Trepanier du Triomphe will be happy to pay, now that he is marrying the wealthy Mélisande du Mouton Noir. I'll see to it this afternoon, so that he may continue to appear as a gentleman. Likely he wants them delivered to his big edifice he calls the Manor House."
"He said nothing of that."
As he looked around the room, René saw Monsieur Bouchard had a shelf of books with gold letters on the spines. He discerned an R.
"Philippe can find him and ask. And you, are you clearing your own land now? Have you built your house? Have you also found someone to marry? Monsieur Trepanier has not yet granted me land."
René had lost any sense of years.
"Indeed."
Monsieur Bouchard took down the big ledger and turned the pages.
"Well, I believe it is well past the time. You have worked for him 5 years and 4 months. He will owe you wages. I will send him a note with Philippe. But have you found land to settle on?"
"I have seen several good places west of Monsieur Trepanier. One, in an old Indian clearing about a mile from the river, but near a small stream that runs all summer and autumn. Another is in the forest with a clear spring issuing from under a yellow birch. It has a fine mix of hardwoods.
Monsieur Bouchard glanced at the wilted lady's slipper fastened to Renée's shirt.
Ah, a boutonniere. You know, a young doctor has recently come to Quebec who is much interested in the Indian pharmacognosy. Every day, more men of talent arrive, and you shall certainly have your land.
Monsieur Bouchard's haul of long words made Renée uneasy, but he nodded as one intimate with the Indian pharmacognosy.
Of course, it is best to choose a wooded site and clear it. The more trees we cut down, the sooner we'll have fine farms and more settlers. Be sure not to cut down that yellow birch. If you do, your spring will dry up. Use the clearing for pasture for your cows.
He sighed.
And, of course, Monsieur Trépanier will continue to be the seigneur of those lands. As they say, no land without a lord. He has an extensive holding. When you raise grain, you will bring it to his mill to be ground into the fine flour of New France. I do not think he has a mill. He will certainly build one. It is one of the duties of a seigneur to his habitants. Presumably he will persuade more people to come to his holding.
Monsieur Bouchard put the ledger away and smiled in dismissal.
Sir, said Renée, I have a question.
Yes?
The deputy's face grew serious.
Marie, the Micmac woman, told me she was learning to read and write from the priest at the mission.
Could that be true?
Père Perrault tries to teach the Indians their letters, to read a little and write. To what end, except to read scripture, I do not know. But that is the way of many of the French, especially fur traders, to be cordial to native people. Not all, of course. Most farmers and settlers dislike les sauvages.
Would he...
What? Teach you? You must ask him. But I am almost certain you would have to come to the mission. If you lived nearer Wobeek, you could easily learn those skills from him. Already almost 20 people are living here. Why not think about choosing land close to Wobeek instead of a 2-day journey away in the wilderness?
His yellow eyebrows went up and down in conspiratorial inquiry. Renée said he would consider all of this, but the deputy knew he would not. He saw the stubborn face of a man with a mind like a stone, a man who preferred to live in the rough forest, the endless forest that amazed and frightened. On the return trip, there was much to think about. Marie, an Indian woman who could, perhaps, read and write, the possibility that he too could learn these arts, and the great news that the time for his land grant and freedom from Monsieur Trépanier was at hand. Despite the allure of living near the mission and the settlement, he had a feeling for the woods. As for Wobeek, that muddy, tiny scrap of settlement was too much like France. A little distance past the place where Monsieur Trépanier had killed the porcupine years earlier, he began to sense something. He slowed his pace, set each foot with care as silently as he could, and listened. Nothing. He went on, but the sense of a menacing entity nearby persisted. 5 years of Monsieur Trépanier's talk of supernatural horrors in the forest, the mnemic ethos of the region, had damaged his French rationality. He had come to believe in the Witiko and its comrades as he believed in the devil and angels. He walked on, the back of his neck exposed and vulnerable, his senses quiveringly alert. The Iroquois were far to the south and west, though he had heard a few raiding parties sometimes slipped through the forests unseen and massacred settlers. He considered what animals might stalk a man. Bears, cougars, wolves. Of these, bears had the greatest magical powers. It might be a bear snuffling along his trail, yet he doubted it. At this time of year, bears were cramming their bodies with berries and greasy moths, eating. As he paused, looking for blaze marks, for they were weathered and gray, difficult to see in the deepening light, he heard the distinct sound of a breaking twig in the sombrous forest. From that moment the fleering faces of demons appeared among the interstices of the branches, among the needles. The fear of Iroquois and their unspeakable tortures flooded his bowels. He might never get back to Monsieur Trepanier's clearing. He might never claim his land. Away from the trail, he saw acres of young dog-hair larch. In there, perhaps he could hide, for no one, not even an impassioned Iroquois, would plunge into trees so tightly packed. He burrowed into the larch thicket. The impression of something alien not far away persisted, and as he rummaged in his pocket for a corn cake, he smelled a faint drift of smoke. It was the fire of the Iroquois. Not daring to light a fire himself, he curled up under the larches and spent a shivering night dozing and listening for their approach. He could make out a pale clump of corpse flowers and other luminous fungi in the gloom. Such sullen smolderings, invisible by day, were the signs of demonic passage. When the paling east presaged dawn, he was on the barely discernible trail, moving swiftly. The feeling of being pursued grew stronger, and he half ran, panting, sure he heard an Iroquois' heaving breath. Then he stopped. Fleeing would not help him. He took up a station behind a spruce a few yards off the trail and waited. He would let the Iroquois appear. He would face their tortures and die as others had died. It was the red thread in the fabric of life in New France. A short time passed, and then he heard not only snapping twigs, but a voice. Two voices. The few sung words in French. "You'll find many Iroquois bodies. Plusieurs corps Iroquois." And then laughter. French. He saw motion through the trees and stepped onto the trail, but stood tense and ready for trouble. They saw him.
"Ah, he has waited for us."
They were short, muscular men with black beards, top-heavy with huge shoulders and arms, thick black eyebrows and red lips. Hommes du Nord, voyageurs, men of the North. But he knew them by their large eyes, Monsieur Trepanny eyes, ebon black irises in flashing whites. They were dressed in the mode of voyageur fur traders, one with a red toque, the other with a neckerchief tied around his head, both with deerskin leggings and Indian-style breech clouts, oblivious to biting insects. Both wore brilliant sashes knotted around their waists. Both wore woolen double shirts. They were drunk and carrying bottles of spirits, which they swigged as they walked. They were Monsieur Trepanier's long-awaited brothers from the crowd of boatmen camped at Wobik. They said their names, Toussaint, whose beard flowed down his breast, and Fernand, with a short bristle of whiskers.
"Oui, tabernacle!"
Of course, by the holy tabernacle they were coming to attend Claude's wedding, and yes, they had followed René, but also knew to look for the trail blazes. Some of their comrades would follow, for the chance of a wedding celebration would never be missed by anyone alive in this empty country. Another of their company knew the path, though he preferred not to join the revelry, as he said he had a strong dislike of Claude Trepanier. He would stay in Wobik and guard their fur packs. They passed their bottles to René, and soon he was drunk, and the brothers grew more boisterous, bragging of their wild and untrammeled lives, singing songs with endless verses. Toussaint said he knew more than 40 songs. Fernand boasted that he had mastered more than 50, and that he would sing all of them this moment, commencing with Petit Rocher. He began well, but stopped after 7 verses. He turned on René.
"You think this is all that we do? Sing songs and walk through a forest? No. What they say? We live hard, love hard, sleep hard, and eat moose nose."
Toussaint pressed a dark chunk of food into René's hand, saying it was not moose nose, but pemmican. It had a burned, musty flavor, and there were hairs in it and nodules of bright fat the color of a chicken's foot. It was chewy stuff and the more he masticated it, the more it swelled in his mouth. He took a gulp of whiskey and forced the pemmican down. Renee had been thinking of what they said of their companion who would stay in Wobik with the fur packs, thinking of the man he had seen disappear into the spruce shadow, and he knew with sudden surety who it was.
"This one who stays in Wobik, does he have bad teeth?"
"Bad teeth? No, Chalice! He has no teeth at all. He dines on mush and broth. He cannot eat pemmican, and would be a liability did he not prepare his own repasts."
"Is his name perhaps Duquet, or something else?"
"Duquet! How do you know?"
"He was an engagé with me, on the same ship, and hired to the same man, your brother Monsieur Claude Trépanier. He disappeared into the woods one day. Your brother believes he was caught and eaten by the loup-garou."
"Ha! He was not eaten, or if so, only a little around the edges. He is a man of affairs. He knows the important men in the fur trade, even the English. He says he will be a rich man one day."
René had his own idea of why Duquet did not wish to see Monsieur Trépanier. The reunion of the brothers and their uncle Shama was noisy and sentimental. They all wept, embraced, cursed, swigged whiskey, slapped each other on the back, looked earnestly at one another, wept again, and talked. The brothers disapproved of the clearing. Their own way of life left no scars on the land, they said, denuded no forests. They glided through the waterways, and in seconds the wake of their passage vanished in the stream flow, and the forests remained as they had been, silent and endless.
"Uncle, you must come back with us to the high country. What good times we'll have again!"
But Shama smiled sadly. He had a spine deformity that every year twisted him a little more sideways. He was no longer able to bear the hard voyageur life, a statement which motivated the pitiless brothers to describe tremendous paddling feats, 20 hours, 30 hours, without a pause. They named heroes of the water, wept for the memory of a friend who broke his leg so that the bone protruded from the bunched flesh. They had put him up to his neck in the icy water to die.
"Not long enough to sing all of J'ai trop grand peur de Lou, which he asked us to sing? It was his favorite, that song. I have a great fear of wolves." And he sang the verses with us with chattering jaws until his heart slowed and he made the mortal change.
This started them off on stories of coureurs de bois who suffered untimely ends.
"And Medard Bey, who suffered painful stomach cramps and died of the beaver disease." "That poison plant that beaver eat with great pleasure, and I have heard the Indians too eat of it, but it is death for a Frenchman."
The wedding was 4 days away as the bride was traveling from Quebec and not expected for at least another 3 sunrises. A priest, not Père Perrault, but a more important cleric from Quebec would accompany her. The marriage sacrament would take place in Monsieur Trépanier's big house. Even now, still in his lightly soiled Parisian finery, the seigneur was directing 2 Mi'kmaq men loading a wagon of goods for transport to that elegant structure. Fires burned in the great fireplaces to take away the damp. The floors were strewn with sweetgrass. Those same Indians, with Shama's help, had constructed a long table under the pines. Everything was ready, except the food.
"Mon Dieu!" shouted Monsieur Trépanier.
He had forgotten the need for a cook when he sent Marie away, and only now realized the great problem.
"What problem?" bawled Toussaint. "Feed them pemmican! We feed 25 men a day on this stuff, and it does them good!"
Monsieur Trépanier turned to René and said,
"Vite, vite! Hurry back to Wobik and get Marie. Bring her here. Bring whatever she needs to make a wedding feast. We will procure game and fish while you are gone. Vite!"
Marie and Renardette were sitting outside the mission house plucking birds. Marie heard Monsieur Trepanier's demand stoically and kept on pulling feathers, which she dropped to the ground. The light breeze sent them bouncing and rolling. The minutes passed, and Marie said nothing.
"So will you come right now, with me? I am to carry any provisions you need. Monsieur Trepanier gave me this for you."
He showed a bright coin.
"And this for what you need to make this feast."
And he showed the second coin.
"El fez shoot good duck with arrow,"
she said, turning it so he could admire the fat breast. He glanced at El fez, who grinned and put his head down shyly.
"A very handsome duck," he said. "Finest duck in New France. Maybe Monsieur Trepanier would pay you for that duck."
"It is for maman,"
said El fez. Then, overcome with so much social intercourse, he fled to the back of the building. Renardette stood off to the side, rubbing the dirt with her heel in a semicircular design.
"I have good beer back at Monsieur's house."
René understood that Marie preferred to stay where she was and roast Elfege's duck, but she stood up and he followed her into the mission house. She put the cleaned duck in a pack basket. She gathered jackets, then said,
"Père Pilo not here. Not know. Letter write me."
She got a pen and inkwell from the shelf, found a scrap of paper, and, sitting at the table, made a parade of marks on it.
"What did you write?"
René asked, consumed with curiosity.
"That feather say, cook, three sons. That write me."
He could see with his own eyes that Marie knew writing, though he thought her letters looked like worm casts, nothing like his exquisite R. On the way, Marie made several side forays to gather wild onions, mushrooms, and green pot herbs. She spent a long time searching along the river for something in particular, and when she found it, tall plants with feathery leaves, she stripped off seed heads and put them in a small, separate bag. When they arrived at Monsieur Trepanier's clearing, the brothers had butchered six does, and Shama was crouched over a large sturgeon, scooping roe into a bucket with his hands. Marie said nothing to any of them, but went into the old house and began to haul out pots and kettles to be shifted to the wedding house. From the cupboard, she took dried berries and nuts. She found the sourdough crock, neglected in her absence, scraped the contents into a bowl, added flour and water, and covered it over. Carried it to the cart. She put the seeds she had gathered at the riverside into the cupboard on the top shelf. She spoke to Monsieur Trepanier in a low voice, so quiet in tone, only he heard.
"Tomorrow, bread bake. Tomorrow, all cook. Then mission."
Said Monsieur Trepanier. "We'll see."
5. The Wedding. Philippe Boss was to bring the bride, her maidservant, and the priest to the wedding house in his freshly painted cart. The brothers and their trapper comrades drank and wrestled under the pines. Monsieur Trepanier paced up and down, dashed into the house to adjust something, out again to look into Marie's pots, then to peer into the gloom of the dark allée. Elfege had built Marie's cook fire, a long trench where the venison haunches could roast on their green sapling spits, and the great sturgeon, pegged to a cedar plank, sizzle. Marie ran back and forth between the fire trench and a small side fire where she cooked vegetables and herbs. In one pot, she simmered a kind of cornmeal pudding with maple syrup and dried apples, a pudding that Monsieur Trepanier loved to the point of gluttony. As it bubbled and popped, she sifted in the seeds she had gathered at the streamside. In clumps and couples, the guests from Wobeek began to arrive, and they sat about drinking Renardette's good beer and talking, admiring Monsieur Trepanier's fine house. They looked into the great bedroom, hung with imported tapestries, and with inquisitive, work-worn fingers, touched the pillows plump with milkweed down.
"It's like old France."
"Dieu, maybe too much like."
They heard the bride long before they saw her.
"Hear that," said Elfege.
The company fell silent, listening. Suddenly, three deer burst out of the forest, scattered in different directions. They all heard a distant ringing sound that gradually grew louder until it revealed itself as a high-pitched, strident female voice in a passion, shrieking,
"I refuse! Cheat! Imposter! Skulking savages! Uncivilized! Peasants! Nothing but trees! I have been duped! My uncle has been duped! Someone will pay! I refuse! I will return to Paris! Je vais retourner à Paris!"
And it was still 10 minutes before Philippe Boss's fur-lined cart turned into the allée. Toussaint said to Fernand,
"She is so ugly, she must be very, very rich."
The bride's face was crimson, enhanced by a liberal application of French red, her orange hair protruding from under her wig. The lady's maid looked as if she might carry a poignard in her garter. One bony hand gripping the side of the cart, the imported priest, Père Beaulieu, sat stone-faced. The bride's eyes fell on Monsieur Trépanier.
"You,"
she said,
"you will explain this monstrosity."
And she waved disdainfully at Monsieur Trépanier's fine house.
"What a shack! C'est un vrai taudis! Explain to me how this hut in the forest is a fine manor house and the site of a great rich city, as you told my guardian uncle."
She sprang from the cart with the elasticity of an Inuit hunter, and the voyageurs applauded. She scorched them with a fiery look of disdain and marched into the house with the maid, Monsieur Trépanier and Père Beaulieu following. Philippe Boss complained in a low voice to his listeners,
"I said, Madame, I have contracted to bring you to Monsieur Trépanier's fine house in this fine forest, and I will do it. What follows is for him to decide."
They expected the bride, her dangerous-looking maid, and the bony priest to come out of the house at any instant and get back into the wagon and roll away to France. But none of them appeared. The wedding guests could hear their voices, the bride's hot and savage, upbraiding and sarcastic, Monsieur Trépanier's cajoling, imploring and explaining, the priest's murmuring and calming. As the hour passed, the bride's voice softened. Monsieur Trépanier's soared. Toussaint, Fernand, and Chama had listened to it all before, as had René. Those familiar words.
"Rich forests, unimaginable hectares of land, fertile soil, fish to feed the world, powerful rivers, beautiful cities of the future, the Domus."
Twilight fell, and Chama, Elfege, and Philippe Boss built a bonfire. The voyageurs sampled the barrel of whiskey. They waited.
"After all, there's the feast," said Toussaint, yearning toward the food.
He and his comrades moved toward the table where Marie had set out the kettle of stewed eels, the roasted sturgeon, the fat duck in an expensive sugar sauce, platters of corn cakes, mousse cacamos, the legs of venison done so they were crispy on the outside, tender in the teeth, various porridges and sauces. Down the length of the table paraded bottles of cherry brandy. Before they could touch the savory dishes, there was a cry to wait. Monsieur Trépanier stood on the fine stone doorstep, and behind him was Mélisande du Mouton Noir, her face red and corrugated in the light of the bonfire. Monsieur Trépanier spread out his arms as if he were a wild goose readying for flight.
"Attention!" he cried. "Will the guests please enter?"
There was an excited murmur and anticipatory cheers. Inside the drawing room, the guests sat on still splintery plank benches, taking in the parquet floor, the ornamented couvre-feu, gaping at the fairy-like chandelier, its crystal prisms shattering the candle flames into 1,000 darts that contributed the feeling of a cathedral to the marriage ceremony. The Wobeek women gazed enviously at the elaborate wrought iron chimney crane that could hold pots in three positions. After the ceremony, the celebration began. Elfej built up the bonfire, and the flames threw flaring shadows on the scene. The guests approached the table, the voyageurs rushing, stabbing, and hacking. The Wobeek residents, picking at the feast meats with refined airs, felt they were in fine society. Monsieur Trepanier produced bottles of many shapes: red wine, rum, brandy, whiskey, even champagne. Real French champagne. Two of the voyageurs brought out fiddles and began to play while the others clapped and sang. The loud music and the violent stamping of the dancers, their sashes whipping and curling in the firelight as they leapt, drove off any pretensions to gentility. Even the red-faced bride danced, and Monsieur Trepanier was a madman of athletic brilliance. The distorted sound bounced off the forest trees, and any nearby evil spirits shrank into the earth until it should be over. Under a bush, covered with a dish towel, waited the cornmeal pudding with its potent water hemlock seeds, Marie's farewell dish for Monsieur Trepanier. She waited for the right moment to present it. The sky was light when the last dancers rolled up in their blankets under the spruce. Only the voyageurs were still awake, sitting around the fire and passing one of the endless bottles. René pumped them for more information on Duquet. Duquet, they said, was clever. He had friends high in the fur company. He knew important men. He made side deals, keeping all the marten pelts for himself. He brought forbidden whiskey into the north and got the Indians too drunk to strike any but the feeblest and most disadvantageous bargains for their furs.
And Duquet is very strong, the strongest among us. He has great endurance.
To be strong was everything. Duquet was becoming a legend of the country. René thought the seigneur had retired with his prize, but he now saw Monsieur Trepanier standing on the other side of the fire, listening. The flames paled in the brightening morning.
"This Duquet,"
Monsieur Trepanier said, beginning quietly but speaking in a quickening, sharpening tempo, his eyes bulging and beginning to roll.
"Duquet? Would that be Duquet who signed a contract to work for me for 3 years?"
His voice rose to a furious bellow.
"Would that be the Duquet who ran away like a dog? Is that the Duquet of whom you speak?"
He looked at his brothers. Toussaint said nothing, his beard limp and stained, but Fernand rolled his wicked Trepanier eyes at his bridegroom brother and said,
"Oui, the same.
He told us you were cruel."
"Ah," said Monsieur Trepanier, "he does not yet know how cruel I can be. Do you return to Wobeek now? I will go with you. I will have the dog's skull. He will serve out his 3 years, and we will see who is cruel."
"Brother," said Toussaint, "you would do well to leave Duquet alone. He is a dangerous man."
Monsieur Trepanier, goaded by this apostasy, screamed,
"Saddle my horse!" at Elfej.
"Your pudding," said Marie, holding out the cold pot.
But René noticed how the seigneur glared at her as he rushed into his house. In the few minutes it took Monsieur Trepanier to make his excuse to his new wife for his precipitous departure, Toussaint and Fernand ran to the riverbank, leapt into Monsieur Trepanier's canoe, and began to paddle like demons, 45 paddle strokes a minute, downstream toward Wobeek. Monsieur Trepanier's horse was slower, and when he galloped into Wobeek in late afternoon, the traitorous brothers and Duquet were gone. The stolen canoe lay on shore, a marten pelt draped over the thwart, Duquet's mocking signature. The bridegroom, exhausted and furious, slumped on the deputy's porch until that official returned home from the wedding, then swore out a warrant for Duquet's capture and return.
"I will not rest until I get him, and when I do, he will suffer."
Monsieur Bouchard was thrilled by this pledge of vengeance, like something in an old ballad, but he had no idea how he could execute the warrant and told Monsieur Trépanier so.
"It will happen," gritted Trépanier through stained teeth.
Marie turned the cornmeal pudding into the embers where, at first, it gave off a savory smell, and then the unpleasant odor of burning grain and sugar. She walked back to the old house. The gray jay that watched everything below waited a day until the ashes were cold and then pecked inquisitively at the burned lump. A few days later, Shama discovered the bird's carcass with legs twisted into a sailor's knot, a very strange sight. Monsieur Trépanier returned to his house in the forest and brooded for some weeks while preparing his expedition into the wilderness to capture Duquet. There was a strange turn in his mind that moved him to delay. He more and more left his new wife to herself and spent much time in his old house with Marie, whom he had forbidden to go back to the mission. Under his direction, she cooked handsome dishes, and every evening Monsieur Trépanier put on his fine clothes and carried them to Madame Trépanier. There was no cornmeal pudding. The husband and wife dined in silence in the elegant dining room, and after dinner, when the maid had cleared the table, when Monsieur Trépanier had drunk a glass of brandy, he said,
"Good evening, madame,"
and returned to Marie. Nothing seemed changed. Marie and her children talked and laughed together in low voices as ever, and their pleasure in each other's company irritated Trépanier, who hissed,
"Silence!"
René wondered, too, what she had to say to them in such long ropes of talk, often accompanied by gestures and widened eyes. Months later, he understood that she had been telling them the old Mi'kmaq stories, and into the warp of that heritage had interwoven the woof of complicated jokes and language games that gave her people so much pleasure. But Trépanier was sure that he was the butt of their half-smothered laughter, and his red nostrils flared, and he demanded silence. One morning, when René and Shama were cutting in the forest, the Spanish maid appeared and went to the old man. She handed him a letter telling him Madame Trépanier wished him to carry it to the deputy in Wobik. Shama snorted and shook his head, but when she held up a gold coin, he took the letter and put it in his shirt. His beaver robe was empty for two nights, and it was dusk of the third day before René saw him again, carrying Monsieur Trépanier's captured canoe, his excuse for the trip, if his nephew should ask.
"What's afoot?" asked René.
"Nothing good. Monsieur Bouchard turned the color of mud when he read that letter. He said he would come here tomorrow with the priest and consult with Madame and my nephew. It's a bad business."
6. Indian Woman. Monsieur Bouchard and Père Perrault entered the clearing, riding double on Monsieur Bouchard's old plow horse. René, hauling a basket of fish, straightened up and stared. The visitors passed the storehouse without stopping, heading for Monsieur Trépanier's marriage house. But that elevated gentleman, who had been working at his old forge, saw them through the open door and rushed out.
"Where do you go, Monsieur Bouchard? Père Perrault, what do you here?"
The deputy wheeled around, dismounted, and glared at Monsieur Trépanier. Père Perrault got down as well and held the reins. Monsieur Bouchard said,
"It is distressing that I find you here and not at your grand house with your lawful wife, Madame Trépanier. I have had a letter from the lady who complains that you continue to live with the Indian woman, Marie, and are rarely seen at that wedding mansion in which she is lawfully ensconced and where you should be."
Père Perrault spoke in a serious tone.
"She wishes to return to her uncle's house in France, and demands the return of the rich dowry given you as you have broken your marriage pledge. You have behaved badly, and the lady is within her rights. The uncle is a powerful man. He has taken up the matter, and it will be a serious thing for you and your position as seigneur. I ask you to accompany us to that house where she now awaits alleviation
of her painful and insulting situation. Monsieur Trépanier followed them silently into the gloom of the West Trail. The day passed slowly. René told Shama and Marie what he had seen and heard. He thought a little smile flickered across Marie's face. When she went inside, Shama said,
"This nephew should have proceeded in his search for Duquet. He should have stayed with that rich wife. Whenever there is an Indian woman involved, there is trouble. His French wife is not the kind to shut her eyes."
Night came, and still they did not return. Shama said,
"Claude will be begging her. He will grant anything she wishes, rather than lose the money and the important position. I know him."
Very early the next morning, as René and Shama were readying for another day of clearing trees, the three men, all in good humor, returned.
"Tell him at once," said Père Perrault.
"At once." And they all looked at René.
"What? What is it?" he said.
He had still not had a chance to talk with Monsieur Trépanier about his land, and he was afraid now that the seigneur had found a way to evade the responsibility.
"You will marry Marie," said Monsieur Trépanier. "Immediately. Père Perrault is on hand to officiate."
"No!" cried René. He whispered, not wishing to be overheard by Marie.
"She is old. I do not want to marry her."
He had dreamed of a wife from one of the consignment ships with women from France, the king's girls, les filles du roi, a charming and shy young woman with blue eyes.
"Also, you and Marie."
It was only a country marriage. Père Perrault let the words slide out in his gentle way. "Just a country custom."
"But no," said René.
"You do not yet see reason," said Monsieur Trépanier pleasantly. "She will help you make a house of your own on the land, I grant you, and I will be very generous. I will grant you a double portion of land. You will have good workers to aid you, those Indian boys, Elfège and Théotiste, and that servant girl Renaudette. Marie is a clever cook. She will warm you on winter nights. She is adept in curing illness. She has value. What more could you want?"
Marie herself was standing in the doorway, listening without expression. Père Perrault signed to her to come near. René thought furiously in several directions. But to himself, he added another reason to Monsieur Trépanier's list. With Marie at his side, he could learn to read and write, or even better, depend on her to do whatever reading and writing was needed. The blue-eyed fille du roi of his dreams vanished. Again he felt himself caught in the sweeping current of events he was powerless to escape. What could he do against the commands of more important men? He nodded once, yes. He would marry Marie, an old Indian woman. So it was done. In every life, there are events that reshape one's sense of existence. Afterward, all is different and the past is dimmed. For René, the great blow had been the loss of Achille, his brother, whom he loved and most dreadfully missed. He came to New France to escape the loss, not realizing he would carry sorrow enclosed within him. The second event was the forced marriage to Marie. Monsieur Trépanier made a formal assignment of land to René, granting him the old domus and workshop and the gardens, but not the cow, as well as the clearing to the west that René coveted and the land with clear water springing from under a yellow birch. René was, in one stroke, a man of property. Père Perrault and Monsieur Bouchard left soon after the brief ceremony with Monsieur Trépanier's signature on René's land assignment. Monsieur Trépanier spoke with casual sarcasm to Marie.
"Madame Selle, cook dinner as you always do, and Shama will bring it to my lady wife and myself. After this evening, her maid will prepare our food until we find a cook and servant. We will purchase a Pawnee or Blackamoor slave or two from Quebec.
He walked westward into the forest. Six woodcock had been hanging for days and had reached the hallucinogenic point of decay that Monsieur Trépanier savored. Marie roasted the birds, put them in a large basket, added a cold leg of venison, 4 portions of steamed sturgeon. René thought it was a supper the seigneur hardly deserved. Shama, who had become attentive to the Spanish maid, carried all of this in the ox cart, the cow tied behind. For their own supper, Marie thumped on the table a platter of hot eels graced with the sourgrass sauce. She had baked in the morning and served a loaf of bread with the last of the butter. Alas for the loss of the cow. Marie, walking from fire to table in her deerskin tunic, looked as she had always looked, but she gave René the fattest eel and touched his hand lightly. After the boys went out to the wigwam, she made up a pallet in front of the fireplace and then pulled off her baggy dress. She stood nude in the firelight, the first naked female he had ever seen. Not an old Indian cast-off foisted on him, but a strong and well-built woman. She lay on the pallet and waited. René pulled off his clothes, conscious of his greasy reek. He lay down beside Marie, who rolled toward him. The fabulous shock of warm, silky skin against him was powerful in the extreme. Not since he and Achille had intertwined and whispered and tried what they could think to try had he experienced the stunning excitement of another human body naked against his. Marie's elasticity, her hard muscles, her smell of bread, river eels, and bitter plants made him wild. She was not Achille, but he thought of his brother as he proceeded. In the morning, Marie said, "Good, you," got up, pulled on her deerskin dress with its faded designs, and made the fire. With a shock of insight, he understood that Marie's impassive expression was a calm acceptance and knowledge of life's roils and clawing, an attitude that, in a way, matched his own belief that he flew in the winds of change like a sere leaf. She had answers to the most untoward questions, for the Mi'kmaq had examined the world with boundless imagination for many generations. Over the months and years, he learned from her. His relationship with Marie became a marriage of intelligences as well as bodies. They stood opposed on the nature of the forest. To Marie, it was a living entity, as vital as the waterways, filled with the gifts of medicine, food, shelter, tool material, which everyone discovered and remembered. One lived with it in harmony and gratitude. She believed the interminable chopping of every tree for the foolish purpose of clearing the land was bad. But that, thought René, was woman's talk. The forest was there, enormous and limitless. The task of men was to subdue its exuberance, to tame the land it grew on. Useless land until cleared and planted with wheat and potatoes. It seemed both of them were subject to outside forces, powerless to object in matters of marriage or chopping. Farther west, the manor house resounded with discontent. Monsieur Trépanier, tired of his commanding wife, who endlessly harped on how much she wanted to return to Paris, and he began to curse the world he had made. His mind shifted from consolidating the domus to vengeance. If only Duquet had been a gentleman, he certainly would have tracked him down and challenged him to a duel. Although too much time had passed, he said he would begin his pursuit of Duquet on the next full moon. Elfege, he said, must come with him as his squire. This decision, perhaps, was bolstered by Bouchard's call for a new road-building corvée at that time. An onerous duty that not even one with a particule could evade. At night, Marie wept. She said it was right that Monsieur Trépanier pursue Duquet if he wished, but Elfège had no reason to do so. Before he left, Monsieur Trepanier buried a small metal box beneath the front doorstep, muttering a curse or two. From the hall window upstairs, the Spanish maid watched him. Trepanier and Elfège left under the hard dot of the moon, and nothing was heard of them, nor Duquet, nor the bearded brothers, until the next spring. 7. Boucheron. Time passed slowly, a long series of days shaped by work. All the second summer, thought René, Marie had been more silent than usual.
Speak, Marie. What is wrong? You must tell me. Is it Elfège? Are you thinking about Elfège?
He pressed her one night after baby Achille and the newborn twins Noé and Zoé were asleep. She nodded and then bent her head. There was a deep silence, so deep the tumbling flight of a moth drawn to the fire disturbed the air, and they heard the puff of vapor as a flame caught it.
Woman, tell me.
He grasped both her hands to show his need to understand. And the long, sad story came out. She was terribly frightened of losing Elfège. Again, she spoke of the time when she was a child, when, she said, her people lived on the shore, far to the east. One day, when they were at their ocean camp, a ship came with pale men in it. The newcomers said they were les Français. Marie's people showed the Wenuge how to gather shellfish and berries, shared food with them. One of the French was Père Perrault, Père Pillot, as she called him. All seemed well for some weeks. But one day the strangers abruptly declared they were returning to France, and that some of the Mi'kmaq would come with them. No one wished to go, but the Wenuge smiled disarmingly. And then, without warning, hairy sailors seized seven of the people, Marie among them, and rushed them to the ship. The anchor was hoisted and the ship away before the people on shore realized. They ran along the coastline gesticulating and shrieking at the ship. The ship sailed on.
Many days sick us. Then in France come us.
France? You went to France?
Yes. In palace, ride in wagon. Big noise. Weeping all us. Bad food. In box sleep. Long time. Brother sick. Cough. Choke he. Wenuge away him take. Die. Maman die. Sick me. Hot big sore on me make. All die. Only me, one baby. Ship take us. Per pillow say home go. Long time. Ocean angry. Bebe die. Then our good land. Mi'kmaq people run. Laugh.
But the joy at returning didn't last. Nearly the entire tribe died in the next few months.
Wenuge sickness. Die, Mi'kmaq. Sick. Same bad my face make.
She pointed at the smallpox scars on her cheeks, then continued. Dozens of the tribe were ravaged by the rotting face disease, and the tiny village became a sinkhole of suffering. He understood that she and other Mi'kmaq had been forced onto a French ship and against their will brought to Paris, where most of them died. Marie fell ill with smallpox but survived and endured the long trip back across the ocean to the homeland. But she had brought sickness with her, and most of her people died. It was then, she said, Père Pillot brought her to Quebec. She married Lolan, a good Mi'kmaq man at the mission. Elfège and Théotiste were his children, and Jean-Baptiste.
Big man, but die him. One, my baby, die. But Elfège, Théotiste, Jean-Baptiste, then not die they. Me to Wobik with Père Pillot. That mission, know you.
And at the mission, Trépanier had found her and hired her as his housekeeper, but within days forced himself on her. It was the way things went in New France.
No him, child. No bébé. Medicine, no me. Lene, you me good bébés. But now Elfège, I say, back come, Elfège. Back come.
It was as though he had heard her. The snow was melting away, a hollow circle forming around the base of every tree, a ceaseless piddle of meltwater running over the sopping ground into rills and streams when a man limped into the clearing. She knew at once.
Elfège!
She ran to him and helped him to the house. The boy was emaciated, covered with the scabs of old cuts and a pattern of bruises. His right ankle was a swollen purple lump. He would not speak. They half carried him into the house and put him on the pallet. Marie began to stir up the fire and make a sleep potion to heat a nourishing moose broth. While she took white cedar cones from her storeroom and pounded them to dust, worked them into pounded fern root and leaf for a sprain poultice, René stood gazing at the half-conscious boy.
Where is the Seigneur? Where is Monsieur Trépanier?
He asked gently. But Elfège could not answer. Not then. By asking questions to which Elfège would nod or shake his head, Marie learned that Monsieur Trépanier was dead, but when and in what manner he would not say. He lay quiet and half asleep for 9 days, then seemed to recover his strength in a great flush. Within a month, he joined René in the woods, chopping. He was silent and rarely smiled, his eyes habitually cast down as though the world was too painful to regard. Chama no longer worked with them. He had gone to Quebec with Madame Trépanier and the Spanish maid, for the bride was again intending France. The Spanish maid was particularly disenchanted with Trépanier's mansion, for she had pried up the front doorstep stone, taken the metal box hidden there. It opened easily enough, despite creeping patterns of rust on the lid, but in it were nothing but human teeth and locks of hair. Even Chama wished to return to the old country to grow onions in root-free soil. They concluded that Monsieur Trépanier was dead. They left by moonlight, and when Marie heard the distant bellowing of the unmilked cow, she went to the manor house and claimed her.
House, door much open, she said to René. Soon inside live porc-épic people.
Yes, porcupines moved into abandoned houses very soon. The uncle of Mélisande du Mouton Noir, now Trépanier's wife, wrote several letters to his niece. Monsieur Bouchard kept them on the corner of his work table as though the woman would sometime materialize and claim them. But the day came when a peremptory letter addressed directly to Monsieur Bouchard himself demanded information of the lady who had failed to respond to her uncle's solicitous epistles. Monsieur Bouchard had the unpleasant duty of writing to Mouton Noir and the intendant with the sad news that the ship had struck rocks a few miles downstream from Wobeek and all aboard had perished. He pretended amazement that news of the disaster had not reached them in Quebec, for it had happened some time ago. Many months after his return, silent Elfège suddenly spoke at the evening meal, his voice croaking with misuse. He said only that someday he would revenge himself on the Iroquois and their masters, the English. Later that winter, during a rest from a long morning of girdling trees, Elfège told René that Iroquois women had severed Monsieur Trépanier's leg tendons, then had sewed him up tightly, closed every orifice of his body, ears, eyes, nostrils, mouth, anus, and penis, and that after 2 or 3 days, Monsieur Trépanier had swelled like a thundercloud and burst.
Don't tell Mama, he said. She would suffer.
But René thought Marie would not suffer. Still, he could not bring himself to tell her that Trépanier had died so painfully, so distressed in his tender parts. René paddled one day down to Wobeek with Théotiste, who was already old enough to march in the militia and receive Captain Bouchard's harangues on slinking, gliding Indian warfare, although he had learned more at Odenak among the fighting men than Captain Bouchard would ever know. Now he wanted to see the sights of Quebec and Trois-Rivières, and would take passage on the next downriver ship. After that, he said, he would throw in with the conglomerate Mi'kmaq, Abenaki, Sokoki, Kawasuks, Penobscots, Androscoggins, Missisquoi, and a dozen other tribal refugees at Odenak, which the French called Saint-François. René was sorry to see him go, as workmen were scarce and expensive. If he could not do the labor himself, it would not be done. After Théotiste's ship left, he went into Captain Bouchard's familiar office. The aging captain had news for René.
A very good doctor from France, now in Quebec, and who is already renowned, takes an interest in the plants of our forests. He collects information from the savages on their use. He has sent a letter to me, asking if Marie would meet with him. If she would show him the curing plants that grow hereabouts, he will gladly pay her. How much, I do not know, but he suggested it.
Who is he? Asked René. Will he come to us?
Captain Bouchard consulted his letters.
Michel Sarrazin. You understand, Marie's fame in curing the sick and injured has reached as far as Quebec. We are not so pitiful here in Wobeek as some think, although she is only a Mi'kmaq Indian.
The doctor was a small man with a high forehead. Wigless, his dark hair receded in front but waved down to his shoulders, his full red lips curled in a dimpled smile. Monsieur Bouchard wondered why he did not wear a wig, and tried to bring him into a discussion of books and ideas, to take his measure. Was he a deep-dyed conservative, or a pioneer freethinker exploring novel cures? But Dr. Sarrazin, though polite, said his time was limited, and he wished to see Marie as soon as possible. He carried a linen bag containing a notebook, cardboard stiffeners, and a roll of drying papers. He had a packet of French needles for Marie. Monsieur Bouchard loaned him his only horse and, rather sadly, watched him ride west. Dr. Sarrazin returned in 10 days, humming and smiling, his linen bag bulging with wild vegetable specimens, some of which he would send to the Jardin des Plantes. Bouchard, still longing for bookish conversation, watched the learned man board the ship to Quebec. The doctor turned, smiled his engaging smile, and saluted. Bouchard returned the gesture and went back into his office. The smoke-thickened years passed, and Crown Corvée work gangs widened the west trail to a road. More settlers came into the forest. Every morning the sound of distant and near chopping annoyed woodpeckers who imagined rivals, then, feeling outnumbered, fled to wilder parts. The trees groaned and fell. Men planted maize between the stumps. The deer and moose retreated. The wolves followed them north. In its own way, the forest was swallowing René Selle, its destroyer. The forest was always in front of him. He was powerless to stop chipping at it, but the vigor of multiple sprouts from stumps and still-living roots grew in his face, the rise and fall of his axe almost a continuous circular motion. There seemed always more and more trees on the horizon. He suffered the knowledge that his countless axe blows were nothing against the endless extent of the earth's spiky forest crown. One spring, Marie fell ill, complaining little but too confused to manage the household. She became thin, the round, kind face giving way to the shape of the skull beneath. She saw visions and forgot everything said to her, forgot her children, forgot René, had to be tied in a chair to keep her from the river. For a year, Reynardette cared for her, but one bright May morning, Marie answered her long-dead sisters, who called her as owls call.
"Those sister, say come."
In 2 hours, she had joined them. Renee could not understand it. It was well known that the Mi'kmaq lived long, long lives and remained strong until the last, and Marie was not old. It was the bitterest loss.
"It is only fitting," said Renardette to Renee when a week had passed, "that we should marry."
Renee shook his head, picked up the axe, and walked out to the woodlot. Renardette, barely an adult, had become beer-swollen, imperious and hot-tempered, always smarting from imagined insults. She would not forget this one. Ends come to everyone, even woodcutters. All his life, René was a défricheur, un boucheron, or, as the ancient book put it, a woodsman, a forester, a forest owner, an axe owner, a feller of trees, a woodcutter, a user of the axe. He cuts with an axe, he fells trees, cuts them, tops them, strips them, splits them, stacks them. His life was spent in severe toil, stinging sweat running in his eyes, bitten by insects of the hot woods, the calloused hands shaping into a permanent curl to fit axe handles, the bruises and blood, the constant smoke of burning trees, the pain of unremitting labor, the awkward saw, treacherous saplings used as pry bars, fitting new handles on broken spades, and the everlasting lifting of great vicious tree trunks. But Achille, his 11-year-old son, found him dead on his knees in the forest, his knotted hands clenched on the axe handle, the bit sunk into a cedar. René, dead at 40 from a chop to his neck. A sharp scalping knife had been set above and parallel with his eyebrows and drawn around the circumference of his head, the scalp peeled off and carried away to be redeemed for the bounty. He was, until the end, a skillful woodsman, his life and body shaped to the pleasure of the axe. And so his sons and grandsons after him. Part 2. Helplessly they stare at his tracks. Shangji, 768-830. 1693-1727. 8. Forgeron. Duquet had escaped Trépanier, but what next? Gripping the sapling he had cut for a stick, his remaining teeth burning in his mouth, coughing and with a stitch in his side, he followed the river west until dark. Before full light, he was on his way again, swallowing whole the chunks of fish pudding he had hidden in his jacket the night before. He drank river water and plunged on. He followed the river from the ridge above in case Trépanier and that fool Sel came nosing after him. The higher ground was rough and gullied. He could see crashing water below, trees half in the water, sodden heads thrashing in the current. Hunger drove him back to the bank, where he knotted the neck and sleeves of his shirt and held it sidewise under water, the open end inviting fish in. He had enough success to get nourishment, sucking the juice from the raw flesh as a spider with an insect. After 8 days, scratched and filthy, lost in the wild, but driven by an inchoate need, he reached another river flowing down from the north. To the northwest were rich beaver grounds, the Indians who trapped the beaver, and the traders who transported the pelts down the river. He began his long walk. In the third week of his journey, Duquet awoke and opened his left eye, the right stuck shut with hardened pus. In his exhaustion, he fell often to the ground and lay with his face against the leaf litter. He was beyond the pain of his abscessed jaw. Swathed in veils of mosquitoes, he sucked in raw air with its taste of decaying wood. On his hands and arms were 5 or 6 suppurating wounds. He had found rib bones with strings of dark meat clinging to them under a serviceberry bush, but when he put one to his mouth, something wild came at him, tearing with teeth and claws. It ran with the prize. He was weak from the loss of blood, not only from the biting animal, but from black flies, from mosquitoes. Then he lost the river.